Welcome to the second episode of Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. Joining me again this week is Sarah Mervosh.
Hey.
And making her Texas Crime Cast debut is Jenna Emily.
Hello.
Today we're going to talk about the death penalty, a fired Dallas cop who won his job back, a North Texas police chief who's getting paid not to work, and a judge who got a slap on the wrist for opening her mouth. And our special guest this week is Cindy Stormer. She's a high-ranking prosecutor at the Dallas County District Attorney's Office who was recently fired. This week, Stormer became the latest person to lob accusations at her old boss, the missing-in-action DA, Susan Hawk. But first, we're joined by telephone by Austin Bureau Chief Brandy Grissom, who's actually joining us by in Los Angeles. Brandy, how are you today?
Hey, guys. I'm great. How are you?
Good.
We're good.
We're good.
So, Brandy, you wrote a front-page story this week about the debate over a mentally ill man who has been sentenced to death. And so can you tell us a little bit about this case?
Sure. It's the case of Scott Panetti. He was convicted of murdering his in-laws, his mother and father-in-law, in 1995, and sentenced to death. The interesting thing about Mr. Panetti's case is that he had a long history of suffering from mental illness for about two decades, even before the murder happened. He had done things like he became so convinced at one point that his house was possessed by the devil that he buried all of his furniture in the backyard.
And he's still displaying these types of paranoia and delusions. Can you give us some examples of things that you mentioned in your story?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that helped get him on death row was the fact that Mr. Panetti represented himself when he went to trial. And so his bizarre behavior continued then. He wore this cowboy getup with a purple bandana and subpoenaed Jesus Christ and JFK. And since then, his behavior has deteriorated even further. His lawyers say that he's fairly delusional, that that he's done things like, even though he's been fairly well-behaved, more recently he's begun like throwing urine on the walkway. He thinks that the prison officials have implanted some sort of Bluetooth communication device in his mouth so that the guards can spy on his thoughts. And he thinks that he's Selena Gomez's father. He's just suffering from a lot of delusions. And the key one to his case right now is that his lawyers say he believes that the state wants to murder him or kill him, not because he committed murder, but because the state wants to stop him from preaching the gospel and believes that he is going to reveal the secrets of their corruption inside the prison system.
So, Brandy, these kinds of cases pop up every now and then, but why has this one in particular become sort of the latest flashpoint over the debate over whether we should execute people who are mentally ill?
Well, you're right. It does come up somewhat routinely, people on death row claiming to suffer from mental illness. In Mr. Panetti's case, it's different because, A, it's gone on so long. It's been about 40 years now that he's been suffering from mental illness, his lawyers say. But also his case has made it all the way to the Supreme Court because over the last two decades, his lawyers have tried to make this argument that he's too ill, mentally ill to execute. So in 2007, his case made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in his case ruled that that the state can't execute people who don't have a rational understanding of why they're being executed. And so it's not enough for them to just know that they're going to be executed. They have to understand that they're being executed as retribution for the crime that they committed.
And Brandy, are there other groups that are exempt from being executed?
There are. And so since 2002, the Supreme Court has categorically exempted the intellectually disabled, so those people who have low IQs, who have low functioning, and then also people who committed their crimes when they were under the age of 18. And in both of those cases, the court said, we can't execute these people because they don't have the mental capability to fully understand the gravity of their crimes. And so they aren't as culpable for their crimes as people who have a complete, you know, mental functioning. And so in Panetti's case, many of the anti-death penalty advocates were hoping that his case would sort of pave the way for the next categorical exemption from the death penalty for those who suffer from mental illness.
Brandy, what's next in this case?
Well, so yesterday there was a hearing in Dallas before the Fifth Circuit Court, which is one of the most conservative in the nation. And his lawyers asked the court to give them funds, to give them money so that they can hire experts, psychiatrists and psychologists to evaluate Mr. Panetti's current mental status and determine whether he's competent to face execution, whether he does have that rational understanding of why he is set to be executed. The state argues that he can't prove that he isn't incompetent, that he's had plenty of time to try, and the courts have said that he is competent and that he has shown evidence in conversations with his parents and others that he does understand the legal ramifications of his case. So it'll be up to the Fifth Circuit Court to decide whether or not to give him allow those funds, and from that point they'll move forward.
All right. Thank you very much, Brandy. Thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys. Good to talk to you.
All right. Enjoy Los Angeles.
Thanks.
All right. Now we'll return to less than life or death matters. Yesterday we had the news that a fired Dallas cop, Jesus Martinez, was reinstated to the Dallas Police Department by a civilian review board. He spent nearly a year on the sidelines after he was fired. Chief David Brown said that he used excessive force with a panhandler who he confronted in Deep Ellum. He said that he was trying to shoo him away from a memorial service. So this was actually his final chance at appeal. His case has kind of sparked this unusual uprising, unusual show of support for a cop accused of excessive force. And there really hasn't been a whole lot of resistance other than from the man who was involved in the fight, who was seen in a video on a passerby cell phone getting his arms pushed, laying face down, getting his arms pushed above his head and screaming out in agony. But he wasn't well. The community there in Deep Ellum said that they like Jesus and that the man wasn't welcome there. So this was big news that has a lot of resonance across the police department and to some extent the policing profession.
So Tristan, why did Jesus have so much support within Deep Ellum? And also, one of my favorite parts of this story is the slogans that sort of developed around playing off of the whole Jesus Jesus analogy. So how did that come about?
Right. Actually, there had been some officers who had called him Jesus. They, play on his name.
Does
obviously
he look like Jesus, or just has the name?
He doesn't. He doesn't look well. He doesn't look a thing like Jesus. But it's one of those things where they liked him. They said he was sort of the epitome of community policing in their neighborhood. That he would come around and he would pass out a cell phone number, that he would respond to, their concerns off the clock, that he was constantly looking out for them.
So he was a Deep Ellum regular, you could say.
He was, and he doesn't live there, but he didn't even know, I don't think, at the time that he was as beloved there as he was. He kind of looked at it as he was doing his job.
So weren't there slogans like, I guess, Jesus is my homeboy, or?
Right. It was clearly a play on that. There was a campaign there. There were signs in windows. Jesus is my homeboy. Save Jesus. There were a bunch of little slogans like that.
And what did he think of this slogan, this outpouring of support from the community?
I actually saw him last night trying to get a comment from him. He was celebrating, of course, in Deep Ellum. So I went.
Which
up,
bar?
It was a Stone Deck Pizza Pub down there. But he was, which has kind of shown a lot of support for him. He seemed very grateful. From what I heard from his friends, he was very grateful. He didn't want to comment for the newspaper, but he he was among all the people that had supported him all along. So he was definitely very, very pleased with it.
And so when will he be back on the beat, back in Deep Ellum, policing the community?
That's unclear. He could end up anywhere in the department. I mean, it's really up to his commanders where he goes, and there's a lot of, fear that he's going to wind up, buried somewhere working dispatch or something. Some job where he's not going to be in Deep Ellum. But it was a huge sigh of relief for people in the police department. I had talked to a couple people earlier this year. We've done some stories about the attrition rate in the department being a little higher than usual. And at least two of the officers have cited this, even though they didn't really know Jesus Martinez, as the reason they left. They thought they saw a cop who they thought was doing his job, and they said if he can't get the support, if he, this guy who's never really been in trouble, if he was, you know, getting the support of the community, he was doing everything he was supposed to do and got fired, what's going to happen to me? Right or wrong, that was sort of the viewpoint of it.
So let's go to another talker this week. Jen, can you tell us a little bit about the developments in the Sir Young case with Judge Jeanine Howard?
Yes, another newsmaker this week was a Dallas County judge got a public slap on the wrist for saying that a 14-year-old girl who was raped at school wasn't the victim she claimed to be. State District Judge Jeanine Howard said last year about a case she presided over where an 18-year-old forced a 14-year-old to have sex inside a practice room at Booker T. Washington High School. She gave the guy probation, which was also controversial. Now, the Texas Commission on Judicial Conduct has formally reprimanded Judge Howard, and the defendant in the case, Sir Young, is back in jail for violating probation. He will have a different judge, next month when he has a hearing to decide what happens. He could go back on probation, or he could go to prison for 20 years.
So you covered that case originally. This was a really big deal, big talker last year. How did this, what all happened? There was a trial, and then judge made a comment to you in an interview that sort of took off and went national.
Yes, there was a trial before Judge Howard. There was no jury, and she listened to the testimony of the victim, and I heard it too. I was there in the courtroom, and she went back in her chambers, and when she came out, she gave Sir Young probation. And I was working on a story about that, and that people were upset. The Rape Crisis Center was upset. The family of the girl was upset. And I called Judge Howard for a comment, and she called me back. And that's when she said that the girl wasn't the victim she claimed to be.
And now, why did she think that? There was something about she believed the girl had been pregnant before?
Yes, there were medical records that talked about a birth, and Judge Howard mistakenly believed, even though there was no testimony about this, that the girl had given birth before. But it turns out that they were the girl's medical records that talked about her own birth. So when her mother gave birth to her, these were the circumstances.
The unusual thing that I found about this, well, I'm sure that everyone found, is normally we have judge making sort of an impassioned speech against the person that's being sentenced. I remember you wrote one about where the judge was saying that the punishment for Sisyphus wouldn't have been sufficient for the defendant. In this case, have you ever heard of a judge saying the victim, you know, wasn't really a victim, wasn't quite the victim that they said they were?
No, it really stood out to me. I've never heard of anything like this. Usually judges don't discuss why they did something, especially in an interview. They might speak from the bench and speak out to the victims or condemned the person who's been sentenced or someone who has been wrongly accused and exonerated, apologize. But this is very rare for a judge to speak out in an interview and speak ill of a victim, especially a 14-year-old girl.
What does this mean now that she has been officially reprimanded by the Judicial Commission? Does anything happen?
In some ways, nothing happens. I mean, she will still get on the bench today and tomorrow, but it's a mark on her record. And anyone who could run against her in the future, our judicial benches are elected, they will probably use this against her if they were to run again. When she ran before, it was too late for anyone to run against her in the Democratic primary, and so she was unopposed.
All right. Thank you, Jen. Another unusual case before we get to Cindy Stormer. It happened out of Lancaster last week, or Lancaster, as they say. The police chief there was placed on administrative leave. We found out about this early Friday. We didn't get an explanation until a press conference at 5 p.m. on Friday.
Which so. I just have to say is so classic. There's that old joke about, you know, dump the news on Friday afternoon if you don't want people to to know about it. And so us reporters typically have to work till, you know, 9 p.m. on Friday.
That was
that was your experience. Okay.
Take out the trash day.
Yeah, my exact experience. So I don't know if they had ever intended to say anything publicly about this, but certainly after we reported that she was on administrative leave, they called the press conference. They said that the case, that Cheryl Wilson, the police chief there, essentially reversed herself on a use of force investigation. That she it wasn't anything too serious in the grand scheme of things. It wasn't like anyone was shot. There probably won't be what we saw in Dallas, which was a $1.6 million settlement in this case. But a man was pulled over on the sidewalk, brought over to a car. It was unclear why he was pulled over other than he was a suspicious person, you know, wearing a hoodie in the summer, walking on the sidewalk at night. And he put him on the car. The man continuously asked, you know, why am I being stopped? What am I being detained for? He kind of he didn't cooperate. He didn't actively fight the officer either. He just kept his hand in his pocket and just stood there. You can see it on the video online. But ended up using a taser against him. You know, didn't have any what we see with tasers sometimes where it had bad health effects. It subdued him. It got him handcuffed. But the video, you know, Cheryl Wilson said it looked bad to the city manager. You know, as the investigation went on, she appeared to have reversed herself, according to the city manager. Just put the guy, after a few people said it was okay, back on regular duty.
So first she said this was excessive force and we're going to reprimand him. And then she later said, no, it's fine.
Allegedly, she said, this looks like it's against our policy. It doesn't look good. It mirrors other national incidents. So she said that, and apparently the city manager took that as, well, this is what's going to happen. The city manager did not take questions. She did not explain this position, but it looks like a sort of case of city manager and the police chief are not on the same page, and they're trying to find out why.
So do we know anything about why the police chief changed her mind? Like, what led her from this doesn't look good to this guy can go back on the force just fine?
The city manager said that they took it to a Texas Ranger. They took it to a trainer, and they both said, you know, there's probable cause, or the DA's office looked at it, and they said there's probable cause for the stomp. The use of force was fine, which in most cases with passive resistance like that, and it depends on the police department, but they are allowed to use their taser. It wasn't – he didn't shoot him from a distance. It was the handheld zap in the back. It was only after people said, you know, outside people said, this looks fine to me. And then she put him back on.
Joining us now is Cindy Stormer, the former administrative chief at the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, who was terminated last week by Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawk's administration. She's the latest of several terminations who have come out and now made some allegations against Judge Hawk. So, Cindy, why don't you introduce yourself to us and tell us a little bit about what you did at the DA's office?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I was the chief of the administrative division. They oversee the budget and the financial aspects of the district attorney's office. I was supervisor over the checks division and the mental health division, 11 attorneys, 5 investigators, and over 130 support staff, and several other divisions and units within the district attorney's office. One of the things I was doing there is responding to the 11 audits that have been going on in the district attorney's office. I'd been in the position 7 months. Before that, I was the chief of the mental health division, and before that I was the DNA attorney of the conviction integrity unit working on the exonerations.
And so you joined in that position in March after your predecessor, Jennifer Belito, was also fired or technically forced to resign. And she was, again, one of several employees who this has happened to. And so you've come forward with some allegations about Judge Hawk's behavior and also financial conduct. So can you just walk us through a few of the most important ones?
Sure. Well, the most recent one, I would also like to say that I'm the third person that's been terminated from that position in approximately 9 months. And the allegations that Judge Hawk took a $22,500 check on July 28th, and she had it in her possession for 2 months, is one of the most recent allegations. There was just a lot of request on her part for us to make expenditures that were inappropriate. And there was just a constant discussing of that with her. And she would make the same request over and over again.
And so you mentioned things like asking to pay for pizza out of public funds, or asking to pay her personal Rotary dues or personal lawyer association dues out of public funds. And so, you know, coming from a newspaper that publicly, a public company, where maybe my boss would buy pizza on the company dime, why is that different for a public office like the district attorney's office?
There are very strict regulations when it's a governmental office. There are certain things that you can buy out of federal forfeiture funds, and food is one of the things that's specifically prohibited. Same way with the state forfeiture funds. You could purchase food if you were at a conference, for example, but you can't just purchase food in general. And the general funds, there's one rare exception where you can purchase it out of the employee recognition fund. You might be able to purchase it out of the hot check fund, but because it's specifically prohibited from these other funds, it's not very wise or advisable, especially with all the other needs that you have in the office.
And now we should note that we did hear from the first assistant, Messina Madsen, who's running the office while Judge Hawk is actually away for what she says is depression treatment. And she said that these allegations were incorrect, that Judge Hawk just mistakenly took that $22,500 check home with her when she left the office for the last time, and it was just sort of lost in a stack of mail, and also that they were just sort of asking about, can I pay for pizza or can I pay for Rotary dues? Those were just requests, or I'm sorry, they were queries, not requests. And so I just wanted to make sure we relayed their perspective. Now, you also have mentioned some allegations of Judge Hawk acting sort of bizarre or paranoid, which other employees have also cited, things from accusing her former first assistant of breaking into her home to, you know, going through multiple cell phones and computers because she's worried about it being bugged or broken. So can you tell me a little bit about instances where you experienced that with her?
Sure. She would come to my office and make demands for me to do certain things. She would ask me to turn off my computer when she was in my office. She asked all the administrative chiefs at a meeting to turn off their phones, and in a meeting once, and then she proceeded to tell us to get out if we weren't loyal to her. And there was long, uncomfortable pauses, and then she repeated that same phrase, and there were times that she would yell from her office for me to come into her office. My office was next to hers, and she would want to know how much was in a particular account, and I would tell her. And then she would want all the documentation for years back on that account. And it would be late at night, and that information is on the employees' computers. So I would be required to call the employees and tell them they had to come down at night or come in early the next morning to print out that material. And she would say, you have to have that on my desk by 8 o'clock in the morning. And then when I would provide it to her the next morning, she didn't seem the least bit interested in it. And then she would say things like, what you told me yesterday, that's not true, is it? And then the next morning she'd come back in and make the same comment, what you told me yesterday, that's not true, is it? And that would happen 3 or 4 times in a row each morning.
She'd what come you in, told her, like what?
About how much money was in the account. For example, the hot check fund was overdrawn, $89,000 was owed on that account from the previous administration.
And so how has this affected the atmosphere in terms of the top administration at the office? I've heard from other employees that some people actually avoid that floor of the courthouse because they're afraid. What have you witnessed?
That's correct. There's not much traffic in that area of the building. And lawyers that have been in my office talking to me, Judge Hawk has come in there and demanded to know what we were talking about. So they try to steer clear of that area.
And you mentioned to me previously that you recently heard laughter in the hallway, and it was actually notable to you because you don't typically hear laughter.
Yes, that's exactly right. After we'd had a meeting and it was said that she was going to be gone for a few more weeks, then I noticed laughter in the hall. And at first I thought, well, that's inappropriate. But then I realized that it was just people being relieved of the stress that they were under up there from the paranoia and the angry outburst.
So also in the studio with us is Jennifer Emily. She was the courts reporter before me and has a lot of experience covering the district attorney's office and these issues. So I'm wondering if maybe I can ask both of you about the history of allegations of financial misconduct in the DA's office. What happened during the past administration with Craig Watkins?
During the Craig Watkins administration, there were a lot of questions about the very funds that Cindy Stormer is talking about, the expenditures in the federal forfeiture fund and in the state forfeiture fund. And there were audits of both of those. And in the federal forfeiture fund, that audit has been completed, and the district attorney's office has to repay more than $112,000 of funds that were inappropriately spent. Most of that was paying bar dues. And there is also an ongoing state audit that should be completed soon. And that looked into expenditures in the DA's office, including Craig Watkins using the state forfeiture fund to pay for a legal settlement when he had a car crash involving his personal car, and things like spending on Mardi Gras beads at a parade.
And so forfeiture funds, that's the money that that's seized in crime busts, and it's supposed to be used for law enforcement purposes. Is that correct, Cindy?
That's correct. And there are very strict regulations on how you can use those funds.
Those two words, forfeiture funds, sort of became a buzzword in Dallas, you know, during the Craig Watkins era. And it was always sort of like, you know, what actually are those? So it's good to know exactly what they were. They're meant to be used for law enforcement purposes only. And so, you know, Cindy, you've indicated that you believe that there are grounds to remove Judge Hawk from office. She's currently away. She's seeking treatment for depression. She's been out for about, this will be, I think, her 7th or 8th week out, and she's scheduled to be back October 2nd. And there's been a lot of talk about whether or not, you know, she's going to return and whether she can do the job. What are your thoughts? And if there were grounds for removal, what would the process be?
I think there are sufficient grounds for her removal, and the process would be filing a petition in the district court. And if there is support for that, then we should proceed with it. If anybody is interested in that, they're welcome to contact me at cindystormer.com and indicate that they're interested in seeing that done so we can see what kind of support we have for that.
Cindy, can you talk a little bit about why you believe there are sufficient grounds?
Because the more recent behavior and this year, it's been so much worse than it was in the past. I know she was in a rehab facility before, but...
And that was for prescription drug use. That's
correct.
During the campaign in 2013.
For yet a different mental illness. The prescription drug use is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and that was another one that she admitted to. But this year, it has been so much worse, it's almost different. It's been reported that she had a complete psychotic break in March. It's been reported that she was in a Whole Foods store and was babbling incoherently. And I personally have observed her engaging in psychotic behavior on countless occasions.
That was Cindy Stormer, a former high-ranking prosecutor at the Dallas County DA's office. Since we spoke with Ms. Stormer in studio earlier this week, she has since filed formal complaints with multiple agencies, including the state and local auditor's offices, and those agencies have confirmed with us they're investigating her claims. We should note that Judge Hawk's first assistant district attorney, Messina Madsen, has denied wrongdoing of financial misconduct. And she has since declined to comment about any of the other allegations that Ms. Stormer has lobbed at her former boss, Judge Hawk. And speaking of Judge Hawk, she is away on depression treatment. She's been out of the office since late July and unavailable for comment, but she is now expected to be due back October 2nd, a Friday, so stay tuned for that.
And stay tuned to our show every week. That's all for us this week at Texas Crimecast. We'll do it again next Thursday. Thanks again to our guests, Cindy Stormer and Austin Bureau Chief Brandy Grissom. Thanks to our producers this week, Tommy Noel and Brian Elledge. You can follow us on Twitter with our new Twitter account. That's at Texas Crimecast. And you can read DallasNews.com for more of all the stuff we talked about today. There's much more that we couldn't get to. There's a story about a Plano man who got a 40-year sentence for abusing his girlfriend. And then if you're not into that, there's a story about a man who is linked to a robbery by a bag of dum-dums. So once again, that's all.
That would be lollipops.
That's lollipops, not by a group of dum-dums. But once again, that's all at DallasNews.com. For Jennifer Emily and Sarah Mervosh, I'm Tristan Hallman. Stay safe out there.